Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koch, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by the Maine Monitor's energy and environmental reporter, Emmett Gartner, to talk about the series he's been working on exploring dams in Maine. So, Emmett, welcome. You've been reporting on dams around the state for months now. This is a kind of particularly exciting series for the Monitor because it's actually a follow-up to one of the very first big investigations that the Monitor published, which was about 14 years ago this month, I think, on dam safety in Maine. And that investigation found that the state's dam safety program was woefully behind schedule in inspections and underfunded. Now, the first story you wrote on this subject of dams was actually back in February of this year, and you looked at a dam in Dover Foxcroft, which is in the western area of the state, for listeners who may not be familiar. Tell us a little bit about how you came to that story and what this community was wrestling with.
Sure. So Dover Foxcroft Dam has not produced hydroelectric power in over 10 years. It used to be, it used to produce electricity for an industry that is no longer there and then got turned over to the town. And when I was reporting on the aftermath of the December flooding in Western Maine, I had stumbled upon Dover Foxcroft Dam because it has a tendency to increase and augment the flooding that the town already receives on the Piscataquis River. So around this same time that the town is dealing with the aftermath of that flooding, they also were deciding on the future of the dam. It needed to surrender its license, which is a kind of complex regulatory process where former electricity producing dams under regulation by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have to abide by the terms that it once produced power under. Dover Foxcroft, the town, was in the process of giving up that dam and not having to abide by those stipulations anymore. So they needed to figure out whether they would maintain it to the degree that the federal government needed them to, and abide by standards for passing local fish, or they could remove it entirely, one of which is a little cheaper than the other because there's a lot more grant money out there for removal rather than maintaining a aging, decrepit structure like their dam is. So the town spent a lot of months putting together engineering proposals and studies into all of these options. They had outside grants and help from the Nature Conservancy and hired independent consulting firms to put these options together for them. And it all came down to a vote in the spring, and kind of overwhelmingly, by 100, 200 votes, the town voted to keep the dam. And so all of that kind of kicked off this series and all these thoughts in my head about dams across the rest of the state, because they're at the center of just about every town in Maine, and other towns are going to have to approach similar questions to the one Dover Foxcroft did. And how that breaks down will depend on the town's views and the role of the dam and its influence on the surrounding environment. And then there are other dams that aren't town owned that require a lot trickier consultation and communication process with the dam owner. So yeah, that's where things kind of began for me.
And that just to, for people who aren't familiar with the dam that you're talking about in Dover Foxcroft. It was built in the 1800s, right? So it was built quite a while ago, and it's really been at the center of this community for, 150 years, quite a long time, right?
Yeah, and I'm just now remembering it was last run by the Moosehead Manufacturing Company. And yes, it's been at the center of this community for a long time. It hasn't produced electricity in over a decade, but before that, it was kind of the center of the town's industry there on the Piscataquis River.
And so what other questions did you want to explore as you were reporting on this? What kind of came up for you as you were reporting this particular story in Dover Foxcroft?
Well, with it kind of came the corresponding safety aspect to it because I thought about, if this dam has a marked influence on flooding, what does that mean for the over? And it has these documented mechanical or infrastructure maintenance needs, then what could be the other underlying maintenance or infrastructure issues with it? And how does that relate to all the other dams in Maine and their corresponding safety issues? And a little bit of searching dug up the Maine Monitor investigation that you mentioned at the top of the show, the origin to this all, and had me wondering about what changes had progressed in the 14 years since the Monitor last covered this area, and that got me into thinking more about safety issues and the state's dam safety program and the issues in Dover Foxcroft and kind of just across the state. It seems, especially nowadays, across the country, every few months that large flood events happen, whether in the Midwest or in the Northeast or Southeast, there are these corresponding questions about dam safety and America's infrastructure that pop up alongside it because of one close call or another with a dam failing because of high flood waters. So I guess I was kind of wondering when Maine's next close call would be and what it would mean for kind of the condition that the dams are currently in.
Yeah, I think when you first came to me with this idea, we talked about we were both wondering where climate change and the more frequent storms and increased precipitation that we're seeing, how that kind of fits into dam safety in Maine, and whether or not our regulations and safety protocols were taking all of that into account. And I want to get to that, but I actually first let's just set the scene with a bit of history, because there's a lot of history in this in these stories, which I found really fascinating. Tell us a little bit about the history of, both hydropower dams in Maine and just, non-electricity producing dams, and how they kind of came to be and how they have shaped these communities that they are in. Who owns these structures? Just set the scene a little bit for us. What are we talking about here?
Sure. So Maine's dams started popping up alongside with European settlers who came in and built mills at the center of small Maine towns and kind of grew around them. So the state's rivers were harvests to, saw lumber, grind grist, other, just industrial uses like that. And over time, dams kind of propagated in those central areas, and one industry gave way to another. And then by the late 19th century, dams were kind of, and their mechanical uses were converted into electricity, and for the first time in 1880. And then from there, that innovation kind of spread over to Maine. And by 1899, the state had its first hydroelectric dam on a tributary to the Kennebec River. And from there, it really took off. The facilities creator as an electrical engineer named Walter Wyman, and his company went on to be known as Central Maine Power, which is still quite a prolific force in Maine. And he began absorbing mills across the state and using their old dams and corresponding infrastructure and converting them into hydroelectric dams. And that kind of really spread throughout, forming Maine's first hydroelectric dams that built on top of each other, one after another.
But then so there was a sort of period of proliferation from kind of the 1880s to the early 1900s. And then we lost quite a few dams, correct? Between sort of the, early 1900s and 2024, over the last 100 years or so, we've lost about 50 hydroelectric dams, from what I re remember from your reporting. And the ones that we have left they're pretty old, right? And we haven't built many new hydropower dams in a long time.
Yeah, they have an average age of around 104 years. That was calculated by a University of Maine researcher a few years ago. So the number that we have is roughly over 100 years for an average age for Maine's dams.
And but we still have several hundred dams across the state, correct?
And they have different uses too. They're not all for hydroelectricity, as we know. There are flood control dams that have created and keep reservoirs that block ice flows from coming into a town. But altogether, there are 500 dams that the state oversees, and then around 100 that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission oversees. So more than 600 dams across the state. And yeah, not including beaver dams as well, which if you talk to the dam safety program, they'll say count just as much.
And who owns most of these dams?
So for the hydroelectric dams, most of them are owned by a subsidiary of a Canadian company called Brookfield Renewable, which itself has a parent company called Brookfield Corporation based in Toronto, Canada. It's a multinational real estate conglomerate. It owns all sorts of assets across the globe, worth billions and billions of dollars. But the hydroelectric dams they own in Maine produce 87% of the state's hydroelectric power. And then other dams, the smaller ones that are regulated by the state. Some of them are owned by towns like the one in Dover Foxcroft. Sometimes they're owned by small lake associations who rely on the dam to keep the lakes that they formed at the depth that they need for recreation value and whatnot. Others are owned by small companies, individuals. It really ranges.
Now, in your reporting on this, one of the things that has stood out to me is the very strong feelings around dams in these communities and the really tricky balance between a lot of different competing interests. So, can you just talk to us about some of the stakeholders in these discussions and kind of the different ways that they're approaching this, and what is it that they're looking for?
Yeah, it's so complex and it really does vary with each dam. But starting from the bigger picture, I would say Brookfield is looking to maximize profit. Their dams produce electricity, which they can sell on to New England's grid, and they can also qualify for renewable energy credits and sell those. So they're looking to get the most out of their dam assets, and to do so, kind of cancel out the cost that they have to put in and operating them, the steep costs for maintenance, as we know, these dams are really old, so they take a lot of money to keep up and running. And then more and more, they're also having these environmental requirements to abide by, which account for fish passage, just general water quality issues. So it's kind of a balancing act of producing enough electricity and getting enough out of the renewable energy credit to keep operating. So that's Brookfield. And then for other dams at more so maybe like the town level, a lot of them are defunct. They might not have produced electricity for more than a decade. And the town oftentimes has been sitting on it, not really knowing what to do. It's gotten past the point where it could be rehabilitated to produce electricity again. That would just cost too much. And the payout in Dover Foxcroft's case, for example, would be decades down the line before they ever turned a profit. And that's not accounting for, all the maintenance and other costs that kind of go along with that in the meantime. So they'll put in money to kind of keep the baseline infrastructure stable, abide by safety standards, and then one day or another, there comes time for a decision to be made about what needs to happen for the dam's long-term future. And so that can sort of bring about these complex emotions that you alluded to. There has to be oftentimes an allocation of a town's budget towards one solution or another, whether it's removing the dam or paying for its upkeep, and that can spring a townwide vote. So, depending on where people are coming from, maybe they live upstream from the dam, they're afraid of the flooding that it causes and increases, so they're in favor of getting rid of it, or they're passionate about fish passage. A lot of these dams are lacking in technical fish ladders for species like the endangered Atlantic salmon, American eel, alewife to pass upstream to the headwaters of a river to their native spawning grounds and reproduce, which is why you see such low populations of some of these species. Other people might be on the other side of the debate, passionate about keeping the dam in place. It might represent their great-great-grandfather's history, their career starting off at a mill in the area or contributing to kind of the economy that formed Maine. Other times, people see them as this draw for tourism for the center of town. You go to Dover Foxcroft, you see the dam and the waterfall it creates when you're walking across the bridge at the center of town there. People are also drawn to the impoundments that dams create. They've built their homes around them. They recreate on them, they paddle on them. So there's a lot of infrastructure and just general norms created around the way those impoundments sit and carve out the community. So those are varied and emotional origins that people kind of take with them when they think about a dam. And it makes the topic of either maintaining them or removing them very impassioned.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of, I believe, Flagstaff, part of Flagstaff Lake was created by an impoundment, or is an impoundment from a dam. Is that correct?
Yeah, it started
Yeah.
off as a really small, I think it was either just a creek or a pond, and the dam that created the was created there. I think it was Wyman Dam.
Yeah, I mean,
It might have
that's.
another name, but yeah, it really just swelled it up.
I mean that, and then there are a couple of lakes in Ellsworth right by me that are really very much features on the landscape. And like you mentioned, like people have built their homes around the edges of them, and to remove them, it would be pretty significant. It would dramatically alter the land around them. We need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. And this month, we are here with the Monitor's energy and environmental reporter, Emmett Gartner, talking about his reporting on dams around the state. So you mentioned a couple of different communities that we've seen these decisions play out in. How is this playing out differently in different communities around the state?
Yeah, so as we mentioned earlier, Dover Foxcroft voted to keep their dam. Right now, the town is looking at some pretty hefty price tags for maintaining them into the future and the millions of dollars. But elsewhere, Camden has been chewing on this issue for a while for the Montgomery Dam at the center of their downtown. It has a very pristine waterfall that flows right into Camden Harbor there. And they were initially supposed to vote on it in November this month, but that's gotten pushed back to next June. And in Yarmouth, the town made a pretty substantial step forward back in the spring, looking at the removal of three dams on the Royal River there. They're still analyzing their options with the Army Corps really moving ahead, just kind of with designing certain options for removal. Two of the dams are really intact. The third isn't so much. So they're just trying to figure out kind of the stipulations for what it would look like there. That will probably come down to a town vote at some point in the future, with like the select board kind of guiding that vote and drawing up some sort of referendum for the residents to potentially vote on. And then in Bucksport, there are three dams owned by a company that took over the former Bucksport mill and its assets. And right now, that company, AIM Development USA, is in the process of forfeiting its three dams, which form three lakes or two lakes and one pond. And that is kind of slowly moving forward this regulatory process, which has never been carried out in full in Maine's history and was only developed a few decades ago. But that forfeiting process could see the company give up the dams. And if no agency or buyer comes in to take ownership of those dams, they could be slowly drained and let out and sort of just resubmitted back to nature. So there's really a complex network web of decisions going on across the state. And depending on whether they're privately owned or publicly owned, there can be kind of these different outcomes for them and different steps to get there.
Do we have any sense of the time frame for that decision on forfeiture? This is a pretty new, this has never happened before, as you mentioned, right, in Maine's history, as far as we're aware. So where is that in the process in Bucksport, and what can we expect?
Sure. So it's in the public comment process right now. The company held its one public hearing on it a few weeks ago, which I attended, and is meeting with the towns individually, I believe, after that. So there's going to be a few months of this phase taking in public comment on the outcome of what to do with the dams. And then from there, if things do move forward, I believe each a agency of four agencies, including Maine Department of Environmental Protection, Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry, Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and the Maine Emergency Management Agency will each have 90 days to review the application and think about whether or not it would be in the public's interest for the agency to take over ownership of the dams. And what that means depends on each agency. If there's a recreation value or value to forestry, whatever, then maybe DACF would take it. Or if there's a fisheries value, then maybe IF&W would take it. If there's a safety component, maybe MIMA would take it. Although, like I said, like we've said, it's never happened before. This is the furthest in the process it's ever gone. The other two times this process was initiated, the owners withdrew, and the matters were kind of solved privately. So it hasn't been played out about what specific use the dams would have or serve that would lead to an agency taking over ownership. And nor for some of these agencies are there specific funds set aside to maintain dams. MIMA does not own any dams. DACF owns a few. So the question too comes down to maintenance and also the condition of the dams. Some of these dams are in very poor condition. The last time they were inspected by the Maine Dam Safety Program, and could take a fair amount of money to rehabilitate. So there are a lot of question marks over them and kind of how agencies, a new owner, would take over and safely manage them into the future.
Be really interesting to watch that play out. Let's talk about dam safety. So we've said a little bit about this investigation, 14 years ago, now that the monitor did into inspections and the dam safety program. Talk to us about how Maine makes sure that its dams are safe. Tell us a little bit about the agency that's responsible for this. Who's working there? How did you go about reporting on this agency? Just tell us a little bit about how this all works.
Sure. So, as I mentioned earlier, the state oversees the safety of about 500 dams. And for each of those dams, there has to be an inspection to determine kind of the maintenance issues and overlying quality of the infrastructure. And also, there has to be an emergency action plan in place in case the dam fails. There needs to be a protocol for residents nearby to follow to escape safely. So the state has two people to inspect dams and ensure that those ensure that their quality is in good shape. They have a lead dam inspector and an assistant dam inspector. And the lead inspector is actually a former lead inspector who worked at the dam safety program for a number of years and then retired a few years ago. Someone new took over and then they left the state, and the state struggled to find a new lead inspector. They reclassified the job to increase pay. No one Hardly anyone applied. I think, if I remember correctly, the director told me that two people who might have been qualified applied. So the former lead inspector came out of retirement and has been serving that position ever since. And that is a tall order to inspect all of these dams. There's also a breakdown in terms of how much or what kind of risk a dam can pose. So if a dam, when it fails, lives are at risk due to the flooding that it releases downstream, then they're determined to be in high risk and require more frequent inspection. And then if failure would result in large economic or infrastructure costs, they're designated as significant risk. So those categories of dams need to be inspected more frequently. And then there's also the rare overlap or somewhat rare overlaps of when those high risk or significant risk dams are also in poor condition, meaning that they're in, one of the lower rungs of quality. There could be some issues with the way they're upkept or just structural issues, and they all require more frequent maintenance. So to get an understanding of how the agency was carrying out these duties, I went through a recent report done by a national dam safety organization that looked into Maine's dam safety program. I met with the director, the staff members, and they, for considering the staffing levels they have, they are doing pretty well, all things considered. They're keeping up with inspections, and they are maintaining emergency action plans all on time, which they got big praise from the national organization that reviewed them for. But where things really become an issue is maintaining compliance with their recommendations. The dam safety program is quite toothless. It can't really enforce its orders if a dam owner, has a decrepit dam that needs maintenance, that has issues. Rarely does the Maine Dam Safety Program return to the dam or dam owner and do something that twists their arm and makes them act on it. So that's really where a bulk of the issues with Maine's program comes from. And they're pretty, the program itself is pretty, they acknowledge it. They are doing what they can to really stay on top of these inspections and ensure compliance with the emergency action plans. And they have been asking for, the funding required and kind of the policy updates or changes that would allow them to enforce these quality control standards more stringently. It just hasn't happened. And it's been 14 years now. They've been asking for this pretty much the entire time. And lately there has been this report that I mentioned and an internal report done by the director, really underlining where the program's shortfalls are and what funding is needed to ramp up their oversight abilities and overall program efficacy, but no one has acted on it. So the question is, especially with this Bucksport situation, because the dams that the private owner is trying to abandon, one of them is in pretty bad condition, and the program did not return to inspect it after it gave it really low marks a couple years ago. So this private company is about to overturn an asset that is in very poor condition, and the program that's supposed to make sure that it stays compliant hasn't been able to do anything about it. And now it could become the state's problem, or it could be the town of Bucksport or Orland's problem. And eventually, taxpayer money may have to go into maintaining and upkeeping this dam that was privately owned and used, built, over almost a century ago to kind of help mill operations at Bucksport Mill. Now a private asset is becoming a public one, and the question of who pays for it and when is really eating at some people, a lot of people.
Yeah, I found the section on enforcement in these stories really fascinating. And I also just before we move on from this part of it, I want to get you to talk a little bit about the funding for the agency that is
Sure.
inspecting these dams. Where do they get their money from? And how, how much do they get? How big of the shortfall are we talking about?
Yeah, so they get specific funding through a roughly $60,000 to $70,000 federal grant. And that is all of the direct funding that the program receives. Beyond that, they pull in an additional 150,000 to 200,000 or so more through MEMA's budget,
Mm-hmm.
but for the most part, that's all that's directly allocated to them. And that goes to paying for, staff hours. They're traveling across the state, so a lot of money into travel as well. And when the inspectors, can't inspect every single dam, they sometimes, MEMA will hire a contractor to do some of these inspections. So that's what that money's going towards. And on top of that, comparatively, what the program has asked for to keep up with all of its obligations and duties is $900,000, more
Wow.
than four times that. So, yeah, pretty
Yeah.
big shortfall between what it currently receives and kind of pulls through and what it wants.
And you reviewed, as you mentioned, you've reviewed some emergency action plans. You've reviewed, a number of other documents, sort of internal documents from this program. But what you didn't find, which one of the story notes is, written policies describing what enforcement would look like. So there are no policies around enforcement. And as far as I understand it, none of the money that we just talked about has gone to enforcement or compliance, right? And nobody has been cited or fined or anything like that for a dam's enforced shape. Is that correct?
That is correct. They have not. And from what I understand, really the only way to bring about compliance with maintenance standards set by the Maine Dam Safety Program would be for the program or MEMA to foot the bill of repairs and repair the dam on the owner's behalf and then send them the bill when everything's complete afterwards. But there's no way of kind of ensuring that, if the dam owner is bankrupt and can't pay that bill, then there's no way for the, a very underfunded agency as is to get its investment back. So, yeah. And then the national organization that reviewed the Maine Dam Safety Program as well really said there's no standardized procedures for compliance or, requiring enforcement.
Wow, that's fascinating. We need to take a little another break. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we're here with the Monitor's environmental and energy reporter, Emmett Gartner, talking about dams in Maine. I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk a little bit about where these dams are going to fit into the landscape in Maine in the future. So how, as the series mentioned, which this number was really surprising to me, but about half of Maine's renewable energy is produced by hydroelectric dams. So that's quite a bit. It's more than I thought. Tell me a little bit about the role that hydropower dams have played in renewable energy generation in Maine and where it looks like they're going to fit into the renewable energy landscape in the state in the future.
Sure. Hydro has been pretty reliably providing for about a third of Maine's in-state electricity generation since about 1998 or so. It's really existed before renewable energy goals were developed, or there's even this idea to strive for them, and they'll continue to play that role for the foreseeable future. There's a tiny bit more that could be squeezed out of them in terms of generation capacity, but really not much there. I think somewhere around 50 megawatts compared to the 750 or 730 megawatts they provide in terms of capacity as is. So they're really not growing. There's not much incentive to build a new dam at the moment. It's extremely expensive and there's a limited return on investment. So as other resources are developed in Maine, especially offshore wind, hydro will provide a kind of dwindling ratio electricity to Maine's grid over the next few decades. The state also has lofty goals to develop batteries in facilities across the state. So the storage role that Maine dams play and kind of the baseline that they provide by being this generator that can go at all hours under a variety of conditions, and in some instances kind of store water and generate as it releases that stored water through its turbines whenever needed. So that role, that baseline role, will over time be handed off to these battery systems that the state is developing. And then you have new generators like wind going along further, and in some instances, solar. So really, Maine's hydro dams over time, as these other resources are developed and prioritized and receive millions in grant funding, the incentive to maintain Maine's dams will kind of shrink in comparison, because there won't be or hasn't been as much federal grant money allocated to Maine dams, and the costs of running them will only grow. And they have to abide by these pretty stringent environmental standards as well. So all of those things will kind of provide some headwinds for dam owners, and kind of, although the state projects that they'll stay, providing this amount of electricity for some time into the future, beyond a few decades from now, what happens to them becomes a bigger question.
You talked a little bit earlier about fish passage and sort of that being one of the an impetus to remove many, particularly smaller dams around the state to allow for better fish passage. Can you tell us a bit about some of the fish passage restoration efforts that we've seen so far, and have they been successful?
Fish passage can range from a number of actions. It can mean full-on dam removal. It can mean these small, like, elevator systems that welcome in a bunch of fish, put them up, and then kind of release them on the upper end of the river. And they can also be these other kind of ladder-like systems. In general, kind of fisheries proponents and environmental groups will say that there really isn't anything for fish passage like removing a dam. I mean, these technical features have come a long way and are more effective than they've ever been prior, but there still really isn't a great way of gauging at exactly how effective fish passage infrastructure is, because doing fish counts in conditions like that are extremely difficult. So the efficacy rate's kind of hard to determine. And in terms of examples of how some of the removal efforts have worked to kind of increase fish passages, especially recent and prime example that's unfolding on the St. Croix River, the Scoodic River, on the Canadian border, where the removal of a dam owned by a New Brunswick utility company called Milltown Dam over the past couple of years resulted in the return of alewife to this 10-mile section of river, unlike the river had seen in years. I mean, it went from I think about a 200,000 or so fish run last year to almost 800,000 this most recent year. And a few years down the line, there are goals to put in technical fish pathways at a couple more dams upstream from there. And if they're effective, it could result in the kind of largest stretch of or the largest alewife run in North America is
Wow.
what, yeah, the Maine Department of Marine Resources is kind of hoping for. So there is huge potential in fish passage in certain areas. And then on the Kennebec River right now, one of the four lower Kennebec River dams, kind of all in the Skowhegan Waterville area, is going through relicensing. And with that, will require additional technical fish pathways. And the three other dams near it are going through license amendments to also kind of preemptively tackle this question of fish passage. So if there's, successful efforts there, then again, more fishways are better than the none that some of these dams across the state have. So there could be more success in returning fish to their upstream spawning grounds, at least before, a few decades down the line, these dams might be removed.
It's quite expensive though, right? I think I remember from your story that the cost for the to do fish passage on the in the Kennebec Dam that you mentioned is more than $6 million. That
Yeah,
yeah.
Shama specifically, yeah, it is estimated around, I think that was FERC cost estimate for installing the fish passage that they will be recommending Brookfield install was around $6.4 million, I believe.
And I think from that same story, you mentioned that that dam could get almost $5 million through the bipartisan infrastructure law funding. Now, there was quite a bit of funding for dams in Maine from that law. Can you talk about where that money went? I think we saw $34 million just for dams in Maine, for about 21 dams in Maine. That was the biggest investment in New England. How are dam owners going to use that money?
Yeah, so the grant that this money was provided through the Department of Energy, the US Department of Energy, it provided funds to dam owners to use for fish passage, energy efficiency improvements, and then standard infrastructure maintenance. For the most part, the Department of Energy did not reveal what any of the grants awarded to Maine dams would be used for. I went through a pretty lengthy process of trying to get to the bottom of exactly, let alone which of those three categories I just mentioned the dam owners would be using the funds for, let alone more specific project descriptions. And was told that it was not written in the way the grant was structured to allow for that, the release of that information to the public. So,
But I just want to pause here because we worked on this that we I remember talking about this quite a bit with you while you were reporting the story. So we got a press release. Can you just go through a little bit of what happened? We got a press release, and what did tell us about what the press release said and what it didn't say and what exactly you did next there.
sure, yeah. Well, as press releases do, I mean, I think it came from some of Maine's congressional representatives. And it laid out all the facts that we just did. $33.8 million awarded to 21 dams in Maine, for these different categories, helping Maine secure its renewable energy future. But we were really interested in what exactly it would be used for, because we know that projects like Shawmut are required to install these fish passages, and others are aging, have their own fish passage requirements. So we wanted to figure out exactly, or at least get a rough understanding of what each dam will use its money towards. So I started off by just asking the Department of Energy. They said they couldn't provide it and didn't really give a great explanation as to why. So next, I went to Senator King and asked his staff if they could check internally with anyone they have in contact with at the Department of Energy, what Maine would be using, what Maine dams would be using the money for. And after a few tries, they came to the same dead end that I did and were told by the Department of Energy that just the way the grant was written doesn't allow for the public release of this information of to what this, money from the bipartisan infrastructure law is going towards. And after that, I mean, I also have this Freedom of Information Act request that technically is still on the books and being processed, although my FOIA agents haven't been too responsive of late. So where that will go, who's to say? It might re reach the same dead end, but at least when members in Senator King's office reached out to them, the response that they got from DOE was that, an acknowledgement of the fact that they wrote this grant in a way that doesn't make it very open to the public, whose taxpayers' dollars it's funding. And at least for the next round of this grant, they said they would try to make the project descriptions public. So we'll see if that's the case.
So basically, we know we have, I think we have the exact amount, and it's in your stories. We have the exact amount that went to each of these dams or is going to each of these dams in the name. And then we have a brief, very brief, sort of one sentence description, right?
For like four, five of them. For the rest, it doesn't say. For like we can see with Hydro-Kennebec, which is dam on the Kennebec, there it's for Fish Passage, but for others, it's not clear.
Future stories for sure. And I think, our last question in the few minutes that we have left here is, we touched on this briefly, but I think it will be a really important part going forward is climate change. You mentioned that one of the reasons, one of the ways you found yourself reporting on this was because of flooding in Western Maine. How is climate change expected to impact these structures? And is there anything being done on the regulatory side to make sure that they are able to withstand the increasingly severe precipitation events that we're seeing?
Sure. Well, I think something to take solace in for the most part is that dams in Maine are built to extremely high standards to begin with. I think the safety program director told me, they're built to withstand 500-year floods. So that is certainly a level of intensity that we haven't seen in some time. But that being said, under climate change, Maine will see more frequent intense precipitation events that could stress out dams and certain conditions, whether kind of depends on where they stand on the rivers that they occupy. But in general, more precipitation could lead to bigger problems, especially if the dams have all of these unresolved issues with them, which is why the national organization that kind of works with FEMA to develop standards for dam safety programs to lean on when they kind of have their when they set up their policies and for inspecting and maintaining compliance for dams, they're starting to incorporate climate change and its influence on precipitation and in turn dams into kind of their guidance for states. So that's something that is kind of being developed right now. And with some of this funding that is coming from the Department of Energy, you would hope perhaps that the Brookfield projects, the private hydroelectric dam projects that the money's going to might aid in some maintenance as well that kind of thinks about climate change into the future for these larger hydroelectric dams that have, you know, bigger risks of causing damage if they fail. But down the line, the state has identified a number of dam projects or dam-related projects in its hazard mitigation plan, the state's hazard mitigation plan, that it will look to tackle over the years. And that includes developing, like, digitizing maps that show projections of where water would be released, inundation maps, if a dam fails, and kind of developing these other electronic resources to get an understanding of what's at risk during dam failures. And it's identified at a bunch of other kind of local projects with maybe like town municipal-owned dams that would benefit from public funding to kind of reinforce maintenance-wise. And there are a bunch of other digitization upgrades that they're kind of working through to project these issues into the future.
Well, I look forward to reading more as you continue reporting on this. Thank you, Emmett, and thank you to all our listeners. Before we go, I would urge you to check out the Maine Monitor's recent story on updates to regulations around assisted living and residential care facilities. It's the first major change to the rules in more than 15 years, and advocates say the changes are really necessary to meet residents' increasing medical needs and address gaps in care. But facility representatives say the new expectations, which do not come with additional funding and include stricter rules for memory care units and more direct care workers at residential facilities, could be catastrophic. The changes do come after an 18-month investigation into the state's largest residential care facilities, published by the Maine Monitor and ProPublica, found dozens of resident care violations, including abuse and neglect incidents, more than 100 cases where residents wandered away from their facilities, and hundreds of medication and treatment violations. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by energy and environmental reporter Emmett Gartner. You can read all of his work at themainemonitor.org and in newspapers across the state. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have stories you want to share with Emmett, you can reach him at emmett@themainemonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Kopp, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.